Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Real Talk is the show that I like to think of seeks answers to questions large and small. And today, we're doing an interesting exploration of what it's like to be a private investigator. I am honored to have here with me in the studio Christine Beck, who is the former president of C.D. Beck & Associates, private investigators, and many other things. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you.
Chris, you're also an artist, a potter.
I started out years ago as an artist, as a potter, and all the other pocket professions that we had in college. And in 1986, I started paralegaling for Bob Krinsky and computerized his office. I had a K-Pro back in the day.
A K-Pro?
One of the first K-Pros computers.
Oh.
It was portable because you could lift it. That was as good as it got.
If you were strong.
And I had one of the first cell phones that you sort of stuck the big antenna on your roof. So Bob was in Tacoma. I worked as his paralegal, computerized his office. But my brother was a prosecutor in King County. He was in the sexual assault unit. And I had a couple of friends, one of whom was a paralegal at Schrader Goldmark Bender, and she was a medical paralegal, a nurse, and an investigator friend in San Francisco. And they said, hey, why don't you do this? And I said, well, what is this? You know, and finally talked to a number of investigators, most of whom didn't have any idea of what it would take to have somebody on board with them at all. Roger Dunn did. And I was a contract worker for him for a year. And it took about 10 minutes to figure out that this was legal support that I had been doing for Bob.
So let me back up.
Mm-hmm.
When you were working as a paralegal for Bob Krinsky, island attorney here,
mm-hmm.
you must have learned a good deal about the law in general, correct?
Yeah. I mean, you learn all the basics. I actually considered going to law school, and the firm Bob was associated with, Gelman Couture, considered letting me read for the law, which you can do in this state. And I just decided the world did not need another 40-year-old attorney. And what I was doing was far more interesting. You know, I was interviewing witnesses. I was examining and analyzing documents. That was the fun part.
That sounds like fun.
So in about 86, I guess we did license shortly thereafter. There was no licensing initially. You just sort of said, I'm an investigator and that's it. Licensing later came through City of Seattle. We were so respected, we licensed with the taxi cabs.
You licensed with the taxi cabs?
Yeah. Yeah, the taxi cab drivers would line up, and then we'd line up in another line on the same day.
I see. So you got your Class C driver's license with your investigators?
Yeah, it was totally classy. And about that time, I met a young man who was doing some court research, and I hired him, and we started looking at background checks for the hotels. And nobody was doing it. It was a wide open field. We got the Westin, the Madison, we got all the downtown hotels and the SeaTac hotels. And it was great. I didn't do much at that point. I was starting to do some homicide work. And not long after, I was contacted by a young man had an article in the paper about what he was doing for Alaska Airlines for background checks, and it was sort of interesting, but I also saw legally he had some fairly big holes in the bucket that he could close if he knew that there was a problem there. And I called him and said, great article, congratulations. And he said, well, would you meet with me? I said, well, yeah, sure. And I got together with him and we talked about how he could restructure his background checks. The FAA at that time was not really giving a lot of advice.
Were these background checks on pilots and crew, or did it go beyond that?
Everybody.
Everybody.
All employees. So about 9 months later, he called me. He said, you know, I've had it. I said, what do you mean? You know, you've got a great gig. He said, look, my partner and I are burned out. Alaska's hiring too much. You're the only one I think can do it. And I said, well, it's just me and a court researcher. I don't think I can do it. He said, well, I've talked to Alaska. They really want you. And so I talked to Alaska and said, you know, this is great. Great idea. This is not really what I do. I do investigation, but I'm happy to do this division if you'll front me some money to get hire staff and get equipment, which Alaska did.
So let me ask you, at that time, was the internet as robust as it is now? Or if not, how No. did you conduct these background checks?
No, background checks were conducted literally person to person. On the phone, talking to people all over the country. I had five people who did nothing but background checks. And they did them for Alaska and for Butler Aviation. Also all the hotels. But the hotels were more of just a court check, a criminal check. Background for Alaska was a whereabouts check. I called the FAA probably three times and said, look, what do you want out of these background checks? You're saying 5 years, whereabouts.
Whereabouts, as in where
we
have
understand
they been?
I said, I understand you don't want somebody building bombs in Iran, but what more do you want? And they hemmed and hawed and didn't really know. They have gotten far, far better and much, much more thorough.
So was this kind of a new idea at the time?
The background checking for the hotels, yes. The FAA had had this in place for airlines and fuelers and airline support for a long time. So that division just sort of took care of itself. It also had access to credit, which the investigation side did. And I brought on three or four investigators, one at a time. So eventually there were 10 of us.
So this became C.D. Beck and Associates.
It did.
And you eventually then took on much larger cases. And of course, the first one that you mentioned to me that comes to mind would have been Alaska Airlines.
Well, yeah, but that's somewhere down the road for me. For a long time, I did predominantly homicide work. I had other investigators doing other kinds of work. You know, we did personal injury plaintiff work. And at some point, I got tired of working in doing state work for the most part. I did a little bit of death penalty work. But other than that, I moved up to federal work.
Death penalty work?
Well, death penalty is mostly mitigation work. Some investigation. Willie Mock was convicted of the Wami murders many years ago, and he was on death row. The other two co-defendants were not on death row. They'd gotten life without. The goal was to get life without for Willie Mock. So I went to Hong Kong, did a mitigation package there. But other than that, I moved away from state work and started doing federal work, partially because it was not as emotionally wrenching, but it also because it was absolutely fascinating, totally technical.
Ah, so the state work you were doing was for homicides, and were you also doing, what would it be, following spouses around?
No, none of that. We did no surveillance, no dumpster diving. We were legal support, but remember, we were doing criminal defense.
Mm.
We were all defense work. And so when I moved up to federal, that's when something like Flight 261 came up.
So tell us more about Flight 261.
Well, again, a technical case for me. Certainly, there were other aspects of that case that were not technical at all, highly emotional for people.
Let's tell the listeners what Flight 261 was.
Yeah, you know, 10 years ago, everybody knew what it was. Flight 261 was Alaska flight out of Puerto Vallarta, returning home to Seattle. It was going to stop in, I believe it was going to stop in San Francisco. And there was an issue with control of the tail section and the stabilizers. And the plane crashed in the waters off California, killing all on board.
How many people was that? Do you remember?
88, I believe.
And that happened
all
around
Seattle
2000?
People, mostly all Seattle people, well-known people. But the issue that I was dealing with, and attorney Scott Engelhardt, who also lives on the island, dealing with was the jack screw and the stabilizers.
Explain what that was.
Well, basically, jack screw held the stabilizers in place, and the federal government was saying that the jack screw had been examined and reported as deficient on that airplane, that particular airplane, a couple years before, and the defect hadn't been remedied. It was unfortunate. It was just terrible accident.
So this was something that the airplane manufacturers were aware of. Was that a Boeing plane?
That was an MD-80. It was a McDonnell Douglas.
Ah, and so
and
they were aware of this jack screw deficiency, and it had not been addressed.
Well, I can't speak to that.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, my job in this was looking at the records, looking at the maintenance records, talking to the maintenance line guys, defending one of the maintenance line guys. Scott was defending him, so in my role as investigator, the attorney was always my client. The client belonged to the attorney. And I'm talking to witnesses, which are in this case, mostly line guys, mostly mechanics, that kind of thing.
And what did you find?
We can't talk about
that.
Oh,
you can't talk about that.
I mean, the work I did is under attorney-client privilege.
Ah, so can you say in the outcome of the case, presumably it was settled one way or another, who was held liable for the loss of life? I believe I've thrown you a curve.
That's in the court records.
Ah, okay. So your job was to investigate the maintenance of the plane. And of course, you can't say what you found.
No.
But that it was somehow a mechanical issue, not pilot error.
Yeah, that part is well known. Oh, no, not pilot error. No.
Mm. No. What a tragedy.
Most of the federal cases separate out. It's not to say that there's not people involved, mm-hmm. because there always are. But for me, it separated the people out. I was working on the technical aspects of the case, the witness interviews. We were looking at only technical issues, because on the other side, happening over here on the side, were the wrongful death claims and all the other things that flow out of a case like that. I'm not working on that at all.
How long do you recall that case lasted in court? How long did it take for that case to be settled?
I honestly don't remember.
It sounds like it's so complicated. There are so many aspects to it.
Yeah, it was very complicated. It went on a long time. And, you know, you don't have just one case.
Right.
You've got 88 victims. You have a number of cases or that ultimately get combined. You've got the technical case, which is the federal case, which is against corporations. It's, and that's about money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so often it's about money. Let's talk about another case. You mentioned that you worked on another federal case, and that was the Olympic Pipeline. Tell us, first of all, what the issue was, because not everyone will remember.
Well, the short form is that we blew up Bellingham.
We?
Not totally. Olympic Pipeline transported various materials from in their pipeline all the way down to the airport here.
What, not just oil?
No. Jet fuel, high octane gas, lower octane gases, diesel. At any given time, there could be a different substance flowing through the pipeline.
From where to where?
It would start up north at Cherry Point or beyond and go all the way to the airport or various distribution points beyond that.
But it was all contained within Washington State.
Yeah, we were. We might have had a delivery point in Oregon.
So what happened?
It was one of those, I was part of a joint litigation agreement. So I'm the investigator shared with multiple attorneys. There are
Yikes.
Multiple defendants, multiple targets. Let's not call them defendants because they weren't defendants yet. And as such, my job was to talk to witnesses, look at computer records. And what had happened, I don't think you could replicate. It was, now remember, I'm working the defense, so.
Who are you defending?
Olympic Pipeline.
Okay.
And one of the controllers who was operating the computer. The pipeline is computer controlled, and the computers were aging, and Olympic knew that the computers were aging a little bit, needed replacement. Meanwhile, near the park where the accident occurred, there had been a dig for a water line that had nothing to do with Olympic a number of years before. And during that time, the digger had struck Olympic Pipeline's pipe, but had not perforated it. So on the day of the incident, the computers are malfunctioning at Olympic Pipeline, and they are overpressuring the line. There's two children in the park playing with a propane lighter. And the overpressuring of the line causes the pipe to break where it was hit by the waterline digger and release fumes and fuel into the air and cause the explosion.
And the two children perished?
They did.
Wow. That's another tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a separate case. That's
so,
not the case I was working on.
What was your part?
Working on the technicalities that caused this to happen.
That being the computers?
Looking at the computers, yeah. Talking to witnesses, running the computers, looking at what the printouts all say.
And did that end up being a civil or a criminal case?
It ended up being both. It had a civil component going with wrongful death. It also had a civil component going on the technical issues and a criminal component going on some of the targets.
Some of the people who were operating the computers?
Yeah.
Was that a long line of folks?
Hmm?
Was that a long line of people?
No.
No.
So there was a short line of people.
Wow. And that changed their lives forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of us watch movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we see ideas of what it's like to be a private investigator. Some of them are humorous. And You know, they call them gumshoes and
right.
and other things that we can't say on the air. But some of them are glamorized, and others are brutalized, if you will, and others are funny. So what's the truth? What is it really like to be a private investigator?
Well, I'm sure everybody does it differently. I had started out when I was apprenticing with Roger and developing the backgrounds business, deciding really where I wanted to focus.
And that was what?
I wanted to work for the very best attorneys in town. And I wanted to work criminal defense because the issues are fascinating. Personal injury plaintiff issues are fascinating. I didn't want to work for what I consider the seamy side of the industry, which is surveillance. you know, marital problems. I mean, none of that. We did do some adoption work. I had a certified researcher who could go into adoption records and reunite people. But
that would be interesting.
That,
yeah.
No.
So you said you really enjoyed personal injury work and criminal defense.
Mm-hmm.
What specifically is it or was it about those types of cases that kept you there?
Because between the witnesses and the paper, the documentation, it's all there. It's always all there. And you know, we did General Motors exploding pickup trucks, and at that point, those old trucks would get hit, get T-boned, and explode because they were carrying side saddle tanks.
Duh.
And they were exploding here, they were exploding in Oregon, they were exploding all over the country in California. I just worked those three states. And General Motors kept denying the claim. But if you put it together with the arson investigators, the truck, the witnesses, and the paper, it was all there. And that's what made those kinds of cases interesting.
What kind of special skill does it take to get that, to understand where to go and where those puzzle pieces might be?
I think you learn where to go. That's a part of being, you know, starting the work, learning from others, and then just kind of being persistent. I think people who are linear thinkers, you know, that just follow the line until it goes off to the side, and then they have to follow it off to the side, and then the dot moves again, and they've got to follow that. People who I consider cluster thinkers, who are enthusiastic people who have a million ideas at one time, would hate this job. Just would hate it. You know, you're always following the next indicated thing. And it doesn't matter whether it's Olympic Pipeline or General Motors or UW Physicians. It's the people, the records, and the combination of the two. You know, you have to like to analyze.
Yeah, and it sounds like I was beginning this conversation with you wondering what the connection was between pottery and investigation. And I think I'm beginning to see it. The artist's mind doesn't follow in a linear fashion.
Well, in my work, it's linear. In, you know, what I do, I mean, and I work with other, you know, I work with and know other potters who think I am just too much of a control freak. And it's true, you know. I work in porcelain. It has to be absolutely perfect every step of the way. I'm super fussy. I'm overly fussy, probably. When I say linear thinker, I mean, linear doesn't mean straight line, and I'm never going to deviate. It means knowing when to deviate off the straight line to the next line.
So it sounds like when you're doing investigative work, you really have to leave your mind open to where it might go. You can't go in with any kind of preconceived notion.
Totally. Your mind is open. You may have an opinion, you know, slightly, but it doesn't work to carry it with you.
Did you ever have like intuitions about where something might go? And did you find yourself confirming your intuitions or being surprised that you confirmed your intuitions?
Yeah, I mean, more so in the homicide work. More so in the homicide.
Can you describe a case without being specific where some of that might have happened?
I did a case that became known as the Russian Bride case. And my attorney's client, I remember being called in, you know, would I come in to meet this client? And he's accused of this, but the attorney is not only one of the best and now is in Manhattan, but also one of the nicest guys ever. And he's saying, now, Chris, don't be too hard on him. I think this guy is, you know, he's okay. Don't be too hard on him. You can be kind of hard on the client. And I go in, and I mean, this guy raises the hair on the back of your neck.
Eek.
And it's like, you are going to be the gift that keeps on giving, dude. I can tell. And I listen to his story, and I'm looking over at the attorney going, this guy is so guilty. What are we going to do, you know? Yeah, you just know.
Wow, how do...
But you do your job.
Yeah.
Regardless. You know, and your job is finding every fact that you possibly can. And
then as a defense attorney, you have to use those facts in his behalf rather than against him.
Totally.
Wow.
You just hand it over to the attorney, and it's their job to use the facts as they see fit.
How did that one turn out?
He's still in prison.
Chris Beck, I hate to say this, but we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us here on Real Talk. Folks, you've been listening to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday. And we're also available on the Voice of Vashon's website at voiceofvashon.org. All these conversations are archived, and we've been learning today what it's like to be a private investigator. Fascinating. Thanks for listening.